Kaffee in seiner besten Form. Mit Cubo wird jeder Kaffee auf Knopfdruck zum Genussmoment. Denn mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Chibo genießt du feinsten Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Vollmundige Aromen dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie und über 17 Sorten Kaffee für jeden Geschmack. Erlebe Premium-Kaffee schon ab 29 Euro. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo Kapselmaschinen in deiner Chibo-Filiale und auf chibo.de.
Stu does America.
Subscribe to us on YouTube, youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Be sure to hit the bell for notifications and get your Stu Does America merch at StuDoesMerch.com. The code is Stu10, includes the Andrew Cuomo's awful mug, which is available and going to be in your life a little bit more here in the next few months as he tries to become mayor. Oh, it's going to be fun. By the way, if you use the code Stu10, you get 10% off your entire order. Steve Dace is going to be here with an update on Donald Trump's legal entanglements. I will debunk a popular leftist talking point regarding tax cuts for the rich. But we start by doing the left's Tesla astroturfing. You know, I'm old enough to remember a time where the left would astroturf in favor of Tesla. They would say, oh, everyone wants these cars. What are you talking about? And we'd be like, wait a minute. We like the real roar of an engine. We like, internal combustion engines. We like cars, not computers, that roll. And they would say, oh, no, you have to buy one. Look at all these people protesting in favor of electric vehicles. Well, now it's the opposite. I guess now they're the worst thing in the world. Protesters rally against Elon Musk at Tesla showrooms across the United States over the continued U.S. government purge, which, again, that's news. I want you to know that U.S. government purge was approved for a headline in a news story because that's what they're describing. All the stuff going on with Doge in Washington, D.C. Not like, government cuts, attempts at government cuts, controversial cuts. No, it's a purge. It's a purge. Here we go. Let's give me some of the protest highlights. You got to see them. This is footage of Tesla protests in New York City. This is late last week. Burn a Tesla, save democracy. Because now burning a Tesla, which was a Tesla was supposed to be the icon of the global warming movement. Now burning one and lighting it on fire is the right thing to do to save democracy. Of course, we also have this idiocy from the left. Here they are dancing and celebrating like complete morons. Because it doesn't really matter what the topic is, the left will come out and act like lunatics to prove their side of the story. In Germany, there's been some bad things in Germany. This isn't near the top of the list, but they did spray paint a Tesla dealership. Bad, but not as bad as some other things Germany has done. France torched the charging stations. We got that going on. There's a picture of that. Now that is a fascinating one because that isn't just burning one car. It's burning the possibility for dozens, hundreds of cars to charge. And that's supposed to be saving the environment. We're going to go into some of the numbers as to what kind of environmental damage we're seeing from the Tesla attacks. That's going to be fun in a little bit. Another New York City protest. This one's probably the least offensive. They're smashing toy Teslas. Now, again, I don't want to call on something else here. I don't want to cause problems for any of Elon Musk's businesses. But why would they pick the green energy one? I don't understand. Tesla is, they do power walls, they do solar panels, and they do electric cars. This is a strictly environmental company, right? That's it. That's what they do. I mean, why don't they go protest the boring company, the one where they create tunnels? Maybe that would be more appropriate. I don't know. Las Vegas, they burned Teslas. Great. That's wonderful. Thank you so much for that. It's a great idea. Just absolutely torching Teslas. Now people can't buy those Teslas. Of course, we talked about this last week in Austin. Incendiary devices located at a Tesla dealership. That's a really scary one. I mean, that could have caused a heck of a lot of death. Now, of course, if you're a global warming insane person, by the way, like Elon Musk kind of is, if you're that kind of person, you would say, well, these cars not being on the market means that they could be driving gas fueled cars, which means that global warming could get worse and kill more people. So you're absolutely endangering people's lives if you burn a Tesla. Not to mention the fact that they could burn someone to death. You know, fire is not the most predictable thing in the world. So even if you think, oh, we're just destroying property, you know, that's happened a lot of times and people have lost their lives after making statements like that. Fire at a Tesla dealership near Rome destroys 17 cars, 17 electric vehicles taken off the road and into the scrap heap because of democracy, question mark? I don't even know. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, obviously. And then we have this Tesla driver allegedly assaulted by a federal motorist on an Arizona road. Now, one of the things that is really, really difficult, and I did not want to pull, because it's disgusting, the video of the guy putting his hands down his pants and then smearing his whatever all over a Tesla, like in revenge to get Elon Musk. Now, even if you don't like Elon Musk, is it worth putting your hands down your pants and doing that sort of thing? I would say no. The other thing I would say about Teslas is, and this is funny because, again, it's another thing that conservatives used to be like totally freaked out about, which is cameras everywhere. Teslas have cameras everywhere. They are a walking surveillance device, a rolling surveillance device, if you will. They, first of all, track your location with precise accuracy everywhere you go. I mean, this is a high-tech device. There's no, you know, I mean, the company knows where you are at all times, can turn your car off at all times. These are things we used to get calls about all the time on radio. And I'd be like, I can't believe this. You know, what's the GM thing where you press the button and you talk to an OnStar? They used to freak out about OnStar, which is like nothing compared to what Tesla has. They have every little bit of technology you could ever imagine to surveil you, including surveilling. They have a Sentry mode, I think it's called, which basically means they have nonstop camera, you know, surveillance on the outside of your car. And so when you go and you do something disgusting or you attack a driver, people are going to see it. Here's an example of that.
Take a look at this. This is video from the victim's Tesla camera. It shows a green car pulling up to a Tesla on busy Route 66, then swerving in front to box the Tesla in. The driver then walks over to the 61-year-old woman in the Tesla and reportedly starts hitting her while she's sitting behind the wheel. At one point, the woman says she bit the man's hand. Moments later, the passenger of the green car appears to walk over and pull the attacker away. They finally get back in their car and drive off. We spoke to the victim today who said she was terrified and can't understand why anyone would do this.
Yeah, it's hard to understand. It really is hard to understand why anyone would do that. You have to love the one sane person in the car being like, dude, you got to get away from this woman. You're going to do some damage. But it's too late, right? He's on camera. The car's on camera. Everything about the interaction is pretty much on camera. So, again, there are things you can do to prove your dumb leftist points. I would suggest, if I may, as a person who founded the segment Idiots Gluing Themselves to Things, start gluing yourselves to things again. That was a much better protest than going up to a place that has all sorts of cameras all over the place and assaulting 61-year-old women or burning their cars. I would say that's not going in the right direction. Now, all these protests happened over the weekend. There was one here locally in Texas at Tesla dealerships. AstroTurf critics speculate Tesla protests are not a grassroots movement, but carefully organized campaign. A Tesla takedown movement informed in recent days with more than 200 protests planned on Saturday in the U.S. and another few hundred planned in Canada and Europe as part of the Global Day of Action. In the U.S., the protests slated for Saturday were performed by actors, filmmakers, congressional legislators, academics and activists who led a mass mobilizing call last week to rally support and described to the media a grassroots effort to buck Musk and Trump while working to tank Tesla's stock. Again, so hard to understand. It's not organic, though, if like a bunch of big name actors are just starting up and they're the ones encouraging you to go to the meetings. The local protest here in Texas was pathetic. It was pathetic. There's like maybe 100 people there. They were all tied to all sorts of big Democratic groups. Obviously, there, you know, all sorts of bills were being paid. Let's just put it that way. And then in addition to that, every report I saw, the second noon came, they're all gone. Now, an organic protest, you'd think people would show up at different times. Maybe they'd be running a little late. Maybe they'd stay a little bit longer, really dedicated to the cause. Nope, noon, everyone was gone. Because why? That was the clock. The clock struck, time to check out. It's like Fred Flintstone, clocking in to work.
They are clocking out. Now, Elon Musk is wondering a question that we're all kind of wondering, because Joe Rogan had posted new Rogan calls out Democrats for paying people to show up at rallies and protest Tesla. Elon Musk says, who's funding and organizing all these paid protests? Local Tesla takedown reveals grassroots protests are what? AstroTurf. This is from the Fairfax County Times. Azra Namani has posted a bunch on this. Let me give you this because it's a little bit lengthy, but it's going to give you a lot of the groups that you need to know about, and we'll get into these more and more, I'm sure, as weeks go on. I went to the Tysons, Virginia Tesla takedown protest on Tyco Road for Fairfax Times last Saturday. Locals calling on America to deport Elon Musk, and saw familiar faces from local Democratic Party activism. I documented identical messaging to protests nationwide and then built a DPearl project database of 304 protests that reveals that indeed protests are more AstroTurf than grassroots. I know when something is AstroTurf. Fun fact, I was among the first reporters, if not the first, to put the concept of AstroTurf lobbying into the pages of the Wall Street Journal as an international trade reporter. While local Tesla takedown protests may appear spontaneous and community-driven, they are the product of well-funded, tightly coordinated campaigns led by national political organizations like the Indivisible Project, MoveOn.org, how are they still around, and professional protest firms. These groups use digital platforms, pre-scripted chants, pre-printed signs, and nationwide toolkits to manufacture the appearance of grassroots activism. And the messages on Tyco Road mirror the language of protests nationwide. This kind of organizing is known as AstroTurfing, a term used to describe top-down efforts that mimic authentic bottom-up civic engagement or grassroots. It's AstroTurf because grassroots efforts, but they're fake grass. Get AstroTurf. One thing I just want to mention really quickly. MoveOn.org was created back in the Clinton administration because they wanted people to move on from the Monica Lewinsky saga. They don't seem to have moved on from anything. They just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. And by the way, we now look at what Clinton did, I think, from the Me Too standpoint, as being wrong with Monica Lewinsky, right? Like, it was obviously totally fine when the politics mattered, but now that we're to the Me Too situation, everyone feels bad for Monica Lewinsky now. So I don't even think their messaging moves on. I don't even know. Maybe they haven't even moved on with their messaging. I'm not sure. Here's more from Azra Namani. Critics say these operations mislead the public, distort the media narrative, and erode trust in genuine democratic movements by masking partisan objectives behind a veneer of local outrage. What do you think? You'll see the protesters at Tesla Tyson's dealership turn hostile and even bigoted, as I do my reporting. Key findings: groups and individuals allied with the Democratic Party have organized 100% of the protests, so not one of them actually grassroots. Only about 15 organizations and their affiliates are behind the protests nationwide. Most involved groups promoting the Tesla takedown protests have combined revenues of at least $43.1 million. Oh, it's just the average person. Just the average person and their $43 million. Troublemakers, a Seattle-based professional protest organization, is among the groups included. A Disruption Project, a Philadelphia 501c4, that describes itself as dedicated to supporting uprising, resistance, and mass direct action. Disruption Project and Troublemakers have sponsored about 70% or 220 of the protests. What does that mean, sponsored? I wonder what that means. Indivisible Project, 501c4, organized about 28% or 86% of the protests, has scheduled 600 hands-off anti-Musk protests on April 9th, has $9.9 million. In annual revenues, Indivisible Action, Hybrid PAC, local Democratic Party chapters have organized some protests, including members' participation in the Fairfax County protest. Other Democratic organizations have sponsored protests, including the AFL-CIO, MoveOn.org, Swing Left, Third Act Initiative, Third Act Org, Democratic Socialists of America, the Fight Oligarchy Club. That's a fun club to be involved in. 50501. Tax Reformers LLC, which organized under the platform TaxElon.us, Action Network HQ, Let's Mobilize US, and on and on and on and on and on. Look, I could be talking, if I was doing my own national show off of the network on my own, going independent, I might have to explain this. The fact that you're a Blaze TV subscriber, I don't need to explain this at all. This is how these things play out every single time. If you've paid attention to Glenn Beck at all since, I don't know, when's the first time you heard of him? 2000, 2006, 1998, maybe the Fox days, 2009 into 2011, 12. Wherever you found Glenn, you've heard him talk about how these things work. These organizations work closely with these protesters that are often employees or paid to do these protests, and they bring them in, they ship them in, they make, it's all about the media show. And of course, the media, I'd like to say, falls for it every time, but they're willing participants. They're not being fooled. They're doing this intentionally. Now, Elon Musk is stepping up. He's vowing to prosecute anti-Tesla protest organizers. He says it's time to arrest. His tweet, first of all, there are no cuts to Medicaid, Social Security, or other entitlements unless stopping fraud is considered a cut. Second, organizing a campaign to call for the death of someone is illegal. Huh. The organizers and funders will be found and prosecuted. Now, of course, you know, he can only do what he can do, right? He's not the police. He's not the DOJ. He's got some connections. But he can file charges and he can sue and he can do all sorts of things. You don't want to piss off the richest man in the world. This is just a bad idea, generally speaking. We saw what happened when Gawker did that to Peter Thiel. And you're like, who's Gawker? I don't even, is that a website? It was. Not anymore. Hulk Hogan and Peter Thiel took it down because they both couldn't stand the organization and didn't like that they had leaked things against them. All this kind of comes down to the point of where are the priorities of the media, of the left? Where are they going with all of this? We all know that obviously this is something just to take down Trump. It's got nothing to do really with Elon Musk or Tesla. If it did, it would be maybe a different story. And that kind of encapsulates the entire situation that I'm talking about here today, which is the left has been doing this for a long time. They've been telling you the greatest existential threat to all of humanity is global warming. They want you to know that we have to do something. We have to. We need something like electric cars. It's crucial. Elon Musk back in the day was like, or excuse me, President Obama about Elon Musk and his company and other electric car companies said we need to get 1 million electric cars on the road. This was a big deal at the time. Now, he failed miserably at that point to actually get those cars on the road. Most of the companies we gave money to went bankrupt almost immediately. Of course, one succeeded, and that one was Tesla. In fact, turned into the biggest car company in the world by some measures. And they hate it. And this shows you what they actually think about the environment. They don't care at all about the environment. They have no interest whatsoever in any of the things they've been saying about the environment all of these years. This is the perfect example to show you exactly what they think. This, here's a guy who has done more for the environment by their rules. Like, again, I wouldn't say that making electric cars is particularly good for the environment, but that's, these are their rules. He's made electric cars. He's made solar panels. He's made a solar roof. He's made spaceships to fly into Mars eventually to get us away from the harms of global warming. This is the most, this is a hardcore global warming extremist in many, many ways. And yet the second he steps off the reservation and votes for someone else in one election, it's over. He's gone. He's Hitler. He's Satan. He's the worst thing ever. That is how they operate. So I also wanted to give you another piece of evidence as to why or how exactly this kind of shows itself when it comes to the environment and how much they don't care about it in real life. So let me give you this. This is I was thinking about, like, how much worse is it if you are an environmentalist to light electric vehicles on fire? Right. If you're destroying a vehicle, a Tesla, you're taking it off the road. It's doing damage. You're burning up their batteries. You're burning up all that stuff. You're sending all that into the atmosphere as well. How bad is this for the country? So let me give you a couple of different scenarios. Number one, driving a gas-powered vehicle for the lifetime. Most owners own a vehicle for about 7 years. So if you drive a gas-powered vehicle for 7 years, you've got 9 metric tons of CO2 during the manufacturing process. During the operation process, you have about 31 metric tons of CO2. At the end of life, which is like, you know, bring it to the junkyard, you take it apart, all those other things, 2 metric tons of CO2. The total emissions, 42 metric tons of CO2. Okay, so that's if you're driving a gas-powered vehicle. What if you take a Tesla Cybertruck off the streets because you set it on fire, and then you replaced it with another Tesla Cybertruck? So you buy one, someone sets it on fire, you get it replaced, and you drive that. Now, you're not doing any gas here. Maybe the gas that you're using to set the car on fire. But other than that, these are electric vehicles being on the road. What does that look like for emissions? Well, the Cybertruck manufacturing of the destroyed Cybertruck, 22.5 metric tons of CO2. The Cybertruck fire impact, 5 metric tons of CO2. Each one of these fires, 5 metric tons of CO2. Replacement Cybertruck manufacturing, another 22.5 metric tons of CO2. Replacement Cybertruck operation, 12.17 metric tons of CO2. Replacement Cybertruck end of life, a couple more metric tons, total 64 metric tons of CO2. Seemed to be going in the wrong direction. But let's think about what the real scenario would be. You buy a Tesla Cybertruck, someone lights it on fire. Are you really getting another Tesla Cybertruck? Maybe you will out of spite, I will say. I've been thinking, not a Cybertruck, they're hideous, I'm sorry. But, you know, Model X, maybe, I mean, a Model S is actually a pretty nice looking car. Model X is okay looking, but it's pretty practical. You go get one of those, someone lights you, but you know, you get a Cybertruck, very visible. You get that, it gets lit on fire, you might be scarred enough to just go get a gas-powered vehicle after that. So here's the next scenario, taking a Tesla Cybertruck, lighting it on fire, and then replacing it with a gas-powered vehicle. That might be the most realistic one. Well, the Cybertruck manufacturing, 22.5 metric tons of CO2. They set it on fire, another 5 metric tons of CO2. Then you get a replacement gas vehicle, that's 9 metric tons to manufacture that. Your replacement with the gas vehicle operations, another 31 metric tons. Replacement gas vehicle end of life, 2 metric tons. A total emissions of 69.58 metric tons of CO2. So how does this look altogether? Shockingly, not a very environmental. If you drive a gas-powered vehicle, 42. You torch your Cybertruck and replace it with a Cybertruck, 64 metric tons. And you torch the Cybertruck, replace it with a gas vehicle, almost 70 metric tons of CO2. So every one of these Cybertrucks that are lighting on fire actually makes the environment much, much worse by their estimation. I mean, in my world, you know, first of all, who knows how they estimate CO2 equivalent? We'll let them do that, which is what we did here. But, you know, come on. Secondarily, I don't really care, frankly, about the extra CO2 that goes into the atmosphere. That part of the story doesn't bother me at all. Should bother them, though, because they've been telling us all of us are going to die if we keep doing things that way. And then, shockingly, the second they don't get people to vote the way they want, they are happy to go down that road over and over and over again, electric vehicle or not. You ever feel like your bathroom scale is gaslighting you? Mine's a liar. A liar! One week you're, you know, down like 5 pounds. The next week you're up 7 and you're wondering why your jeans shrunk in the wash. What's going on with my washing machine? You're not alone. Yo-yo dieting is real. It's frustrating and actually be dangerous for you. Studies link it to heart attacks and strokes and type 2 diabetes and so much more. That's why doctors created something called Lean. Lean is a supplement backed by real science, and it targets weight loss in 3 smart ways. First, it helps you get your blood sugar in check. Second, it fights off those late night cravings that hit like a freight train. You know how those are. And third, it helps your body burn fat by converting it into energy. If you're done with the, you know, lose it, gain it sort of cycle, and you want the real weight at the real healthy pace, you want to lose some weight at that pace, then Lean was built for you. Check it out. Get started today with 20% off your first order. Just head to takelean.com. Use the code STU20. Takelean.com. The code is STU20. Go to takelean.com. Promo code is STU20.
Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Zespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
I want to bring in Steve Dace, host of the appropriately titled The Steve Dace Show, right here on Blaze TV. He's author of the new article, Trump's War Against the Deep State Starts with the Courts. You can find it here at theblaze.com or over at my Twitter/X account. Steve, thanks so much for taking the time coming on the program.
Thank you. And Stu, thanks for the public service announcement, by the way. I was thinking of blowing up a Tesla just today, in fact. But the data that you shared on what that would do to my carbon footprint has me seeing the error of my way. So I repent. Thank you.
It's highly concerning if you actually cared about the environment. As we know, the left doesn't. I want to get into your article a little bit, but you're talking about the what to do with a court system here in America that has really overreached what it's supposed to be doing. And it's a fascinating conversation about where we are right now. But before we get there, take me back to 2010. You're in Iowa and you're thinking about this already and trying to figure out what to do about it.
So the state of Iowa's constitution is unique in that it does specifically grant judicial review to the courts. Remember, the U.S. Constitution does not. It was the famous case. Maybe it's implied, maybe it's not. The famous case, Marbury versus Madison, early in our republic, where the court essentially found that power within itself. The state of Iowa's constitution does, Stu, provide the courts judicial review, but also makes it very clear. They cannot give affirmative orders that then take the place of law. So they're allowed to review as part of advice and consent, but they cannot make law that solely resides in the power of the legislature. So when we were having all the gay marriage fights in this country in the 2000s and leading up into the 2010s, we had one local judge in Iowa that decided that he could decide marriage law for an entire state. That went to the Supreme Court. His opinion was upheld. And then the court took the extraordinary step of then saying in the next 30 days, every one of Iowa's 99 county clerks has now got to start issuing marriage licenses for homosexuals. And that just goes clearly against what's in our state constitution. And so I was one of the people that helped put the movement on the ground to oppose those justices. We were the first state ever to take out three Supreme Court justices via retention election. It had never happened before, not for the reasons we did it, which was one of their opinions, not for some form of moral turpitude or something else. And the entire time during this conversation, we debated. I mean, I debated former members of the state Supreme Court, lots of legal scholars, and it was I was fascinated to hear how little detail they had for their answers and how much their answers really were a court determines its own jurisdiction. The courts are the final say. The courts are not just an independent branch of the other two branches, but are effectively independent of the will of the people. They cannot be checked and balanced. They cannot be reined in. And the reaction that many Iowans received to hearing this just laid out in the most smug elitism you could possibly imagine probably did more to boost our cause, Stu, than anything we could even have rightly argued ourselves. And so I learned a lot through this exercise. Frankly, the success of that campaign, it's why I'm where I'm at right now. A group of the people that helped to fund it came to me afterwards and said, we wouldn't have won it without you. And they put a company around me to try to take me out nationally to get noticed beyond just Des Moines. And so, you know, I'm one of the few people I'm aware of anyway that has waged any kind of public relations fight against the so-called judicial supremacy, or what I like to call in this case, a judicial coup. And so I think we learned some valuable lessons in that victory of what will and won't rally the people.
Mm-hmm. It's very true. You are uniquely prepared for this very moment that we're in here looking at with the Trump administration, what he's trying to do. And you talk about it in your piece that it's not just about, esoteric constitutional argument, you know, and there's really time for those things. We've all had them, and I think they're interesting. Mm-hmm. But also, it's bigger than that. It's not just political power, but it's political will. And those things are also part of this whole conversation. Can you kind of talk about the dynamic between, I don't know, maybe the way conservatives have thought about this in the past and where we are now?
Sure. Conservatives, we think politics is a process. And so we want to make sure that all due process is followed, because that's how we make sure we come to an outcome that is not equitable, but fair, in that people believe every voice was heard, a contest was had, rules were kept, and then a final objective score was made, and you win some and you lose some. If you lose, you pick yourself up, go on to the next one. That's all well and good if you have an intact social compact, or you have a functioning e pluribus unum, and you have codes and ethics that are united amongst the people and hold everybody to an equal amount of stock. We don't have that right now, and we haven't had that for many, many years. And that's because the left has internalized the idea that power is really, or politics is really about power and control. And so what they will do is actually come to the policy conclusion they want, and then they will concoct, contrive, craft the policy by which to make it legal, or to quote the great prophet Emperor Palpatine, I will make it legal. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. And so we're left over here arguing following the process. While they're over there, they've already moved on to the next thing, the next norm, the next tradition, the next institution they're going to capture and march through and then decide how they're going to frame it as legitimate. And because of this, they have sprinted towards Gomorrah. The only thing Robert Bork was ever mad about, was ever wrong about. We don't slouch, we sprint. They have sprinted there for a generation while we are over here arguing process. And I think what the Trump administration realizes and what a lot of millions of people that have been turning to Trump as their leader for the last decade long ago realized, that's not going to work. We cannot have a sustainable framework that way. And at some point now, our side has got to start matching their level of intensity. Now, I'm a Christian, so I have some limitations about how much I am allowed to go to beat my opponent, although it's probably way further than your Hawaiian shirt wearing, sweater vested, and pleated khaki pastor is telling you. Okay?
Yeah.
For example, turn the other cheek does not mean you just let someone come in when you're fully armed and let them murder your wife and kids. That's not what it means. Okay? And so there's plenty more that we could do, and it's time now that we start doing it. And, you know, we've had this in the courts before in the 1850s as we are hashing out, at least trying to legislatively, the slavery question. The Supreme Court basically stepped in and tried to step on all the various compromises that you and I would argue today were immoral, but at least they were being crafted through a legislative process. And the Supreme Court tried to trump all of those in the infamous Dred Scott decision, in which it said, we acknowledge that you are a person named Dred Scott, but we're going to view you as property anyway. And that would essentially go ahead and give the okay to expand slavery coast to coast, even into the new Western territories. As a response to that, once he became president, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which was a specific check against the Dred Scott decision to say, hey, within the Union, there will be no slavery. And within Union states, blacks are, in case you weren't, it wasn't already made clear, blacks are free within Union states. And that's really the last time we've had a check and balance against an overwhelming court. If you read Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail, it's funny. He's arguing with liberal white ministers who are telling him, just wait for the courts to decide, like they did Brown versus Board of Education. And Martin Luther King Jr.'s like, that was a decade ago. I'm in prison right now for arguing with Brown versus Board of Education ruled a decade ago. We are not supposed to hammer these things out via the courts, but by the will of the people. And when the people want, and if the government and the courts rule something that is not moral and not constitutional, we have a civic and moral duty to oppose it, right? And I think that that is the kind of ground that Trump is upon right now. I think if you look at the courts, they are fulfilling what Jefferson warned of 200 years ago, that the Constitution would become a, quote, mere thing of wax, end quote, in the hands of judges who believe they are the ultimate and final say on what it means. And they don't get to just have a say, but the final say over the other two branches, and therefore over the will of the people, since those are the two branches, the president and the legislature, that are directly elected by the people and the courts are not. And this is where we are now, Stu, and this is why we have a society where, on one end, if you are an unborn baby in the belly of a native-born American woman, and your cuticle is barely dangling from her birth canal, we can snuff you out. And the same judges will say to a Venezuelan drug lord, however, who's not from here and only came here to do harm to the country, you have more of a right to be here in America than that unborn baby in the womb of a Native American woman. And so that's just not a sustainable model for any culture. We cannot live like this. It's not fair. It's not meant to be. It's meant to give the other side power and control, and for us to be arguing dots and tittles and codicils and subsections, when really now we need to take the fight right to the ultimate question here, which is, who's really sovereign in America? Is it the people or is it the judges? Is it is it we the people or these the judges?
It's a fascinating back and forth. And it's such an interesting thing, I think, as far as the time we're in right now. This is probably an unfair question with only a couple of minutes left here, Steve, but, you know, do what you can.
I love unfair questions. Go ahead.
Okay. How do we do something about this, number one? Number two, do something about it within the means that we're comfortable. As you noted, there are lines, the Constitution, our faith, there's lots of lines there. And number three, do you feel like the Trump administration is staffed with people who have thought about this with enough depth to be able to pull both of those things off?
Number one, there are numerous constitutionally articulated mechanisms that the legislature has. But, I mean, for this to be a do-nothing Congress would be a compliment. Okay. So number two, the process by which is very simple. The president took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution and defend it against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. All right. The Supreme Court is saying he cannot fulfill that. in a clear context that the court grants him, the defense of the borders of the United States of America. John Roberts cannot tell Arizona and Texas they can't defend their states from immigration because it's a federal issue, and then turn around and say, but the president can't do it either. Someone is empowered to do this, Stu. Someone is. And it's very clear the president is. And the president should take the power derived from the people, government by the consent of the governed, to do that, choose this issue, which has overwhelming popularity on his side, and make the case that the courts do not have power here. This is power they are claiming they have. They don't. I'm going to carry out the will of the people. All three branches get to interpret the Constitution. And then you voters, you get to decide whose interpretation you agree with. If you like the court's interpretation that Venezuelan drug lords have a right to live in America, vote Democrat in the next election. And if you like mine, okay, then vote for us. And that's ultimately how this is supposed to work. Not unelected NGOs and bureaucrats in the intelligence community conducting coups called Russia collusion, or unelected bureaucrats in the healthcare sector conducting coups called the scandemic, or unelected judges in the judicial sector conducting coups, okay, and calling them orders. All right. Take the case to the American people, ultimately. If we cannot defend the borders of the country, we don't have a country.
It's very, very true. Do you think, last part of this, does the Trump administration, I mean, you've thought about this in depth for a very long time, as we've talked about, you know, much more than a decade. Do you get the sense, I mean, you know the people that are in there. Do they have this approach to walk both of those lines?
I think at the very minimum, you know, we've never had somebody who's an advisor as close to the president and as prominent in the White House as Stephen Miller is saying the things about the courts that he's saying, which are many things you just heard from me. So I think at a bare minimum, they are hashing this out internally as a team. And Miller at least has enough clearance to make his case in public in order to persuade the president. That's, I think, at a minimum. At a maximum, I think he's being sent out there to till the soil and set the stage for what's to come. Here's the reality, Stu. Russia collusion stillborn the first 3 years of the Trump presidency. And then the scamdemic stillborn the last year. The intent of this judicial coup is the exact same thing. And so the same thing will happen to Trump's second term that happened to his first term if they don't carry out the will of the people. There is nothing more populist than taking the power that belongs to the people, taking it away from unelected bureaucrats and giving it back to the people. And that's what the president should do.
It's a really, really important conversation going on right now. Steve is leading it. It's Trump's war against the deep state starts with the court. It's available on theblaze.com. Make sure you read this piece from Steve Dace, and of course, catch him right here on Blaze TV as well, Steve Dace Show. Again, the piece we'll put on my Twitter account as well. It's Trump's war against the deep state starts with the courts. Steve, thanks so much for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
You bet, brother. Good to see you. Thank you.
Axios has a scoop. Not a scooplet. That would be less relevant than a scoop. They've got an actual scoop. And this scoop is scoop! Trump might let taxes rise for the rich to cover breaks on tips. Now, it goes into this, and they say they have a quote from an unnamed White House official. If we renew tax cuts for the rich by throwing people off of Medicaid, we're going to get effing slaughtered. They're worried about the public reaction to their policies. This is what makes me think this scoop is not much of a scoop at all. Really, are they? Are they? I mean, these are people. They will walk through any, like, they're deporting people. They'll have all the sad, the puppy dog eye people. They threw us out of the country. My brother was just a Venezuelan gang member. He deserves to be here too. They'll go through that whole thing, all the sobs, all the tears. They will sit here on TV and tell us with a straight face over and over again that the exact timing of a bombing was not classified information. No worries about that at all. They don't care what the public says at the end of the day. They're going to defend the policies they want to defend. If they want to defend tax cuts for the rich, they can do it. I mean, certainly we can't do all that other stuff. If we do all that other stuff and we can't defend a Republican tax cut, seriously, just cut them more. If you want to cut all, you want to do the no tax on tips thing, I know it was a campaign promise. Fine. There's about 47 things he promised for individual groups on taxes. But raising them should not be part of the program here. OK, that's kind of nutty. And I think at the end of the day, probably maybe something that someone in the administration was floating a trial balloon on. But I can't believe Trump is really not going to have the balls to stand up for a tax cut. I don't know. We'll see. Next up, we have also a family that's not going to have to worry about tax cuts on the rich because they're no longer rich. A woman has accidentally binned or thrown out a $3 million Bitcoin fortune in the worst mistake ever. A couple says they're struggling to move on with their lives after accidentally throwing out their $3 million Bitcoin fortune. Now, it goes on to talk about this, and it says it was in a drawer with old receipts, dead batteries, and tangled wires. She says, I assumed it was one of my school memory sticks and threw it out without thinking. Days later, husband, Tom, 36, couldn't find the flash drive and asked her about where it had gone. She said, he asked if I'd seen a little black USB stick he uses for Bitcoin. I froze. I knew instantly my heart just sank. They did look for it. They went through all their trash. They could not find it. I got to say, though, the guy that's stashing his $3 million Bitcoin fortune in a USB drive in a drawer with old wires, either this story's not true, and I think that's a possibility. I think there's a possibility, and it's not a bad idea to make a big story like this and then hope someone starts a GoFundMe for you. So I think it's possible that's where it went. But if this story is true, the dude's just as much at fault there. You don't put $3 million in a junk drawer. I'm not going out on a limb there, am I? I mean, I know the government would just burn $3 million and not even think about it. But when you're an individual family, you put that at least in a safe, a fireproof safe. Somewhere really super duper special. Some maybe inside of another safe. You lock that thing away so that no one can get at it. You don't jump it in. You don't drop it in there with the old duck sauce packets. So I think this guy's just as much at fault as she is. So the EU just told everyone to stockpile food, water, flashlights, and medications, which begs the question, what do they know and we don't? When the same people who once said, don't worry about it at all, are now handing out prepper checklists, maybe it's time to start laughing about, something other than the tinfoil hat crowd and start paying attention. If we learned anything since 2020 and COVID, it's that, chaos does not RSVP. It just kind of shows up. Empty shelves, broken systems, and good luck getting a doctor on the phone when you need it. That's why I have the Jace case. It's 5 emergency use antibiotics packed and ready to go when everything else falls apart. No supply chain drama, no pharmacy roulette, just what you need when you need it. And, you can even add on ivermectin if you're looking to make your very sick horse healthy, because all it is horse paste. At least that's what I was told once. Be smart. Look ahead. Go to Jace.com. Use the promo code STU for the discount. Jace.com. Promo code is STU. It's JASE.com. Promo code STU. Another near miss at the Reagan International Airport. A plane, United Airplane or Airlines plane, made contact with a kite. Yes, this is a real story. A kite. A pilot flying over a park hit a kite. Who knows what that could have led to? I will say, I worked pretty hard on Countdown to the Next Aviation Disaster, which is a documentary I did for Blaze Originals late last year. BlazeOriginals.com/stew, by the way, is a place to go to watch it. But I thought it was pretty thorough. In reality, we didn't even cover the kite situation. We didn't even talk about it. We didn't even mention kites one time in the documentary, but it's another thing you have to worry about when you're going to take your kids to Disneyland. So there you go. By the way, it's blazeoriginals.com /stew. Countdown to the Next Aviation Disaster. Also available on YouTube if you wish to check it out there. What's going on in the skies? What about all that DEI stuff? How competent are we when it comes to our aviation situation? It's not very, you're not going to feel super confident getting in a plane next time, but it is important information that you need to know. Countdown to the Next Aviation Disaster, available on YouTube and blazeoriginals.com/stew. Okay. So here's what happened.
Understand that this could be you living in a Northeast Portland neighborhood, minding your own business when he shows up in the middle of the night. This all started in September when Van Dyne and his wife noticed their garbage bins had not been collected.
So I went to open the blue bin, and lo and behold, there was a nice deposit of gallon-sized bottles of urine, to put it plainly. And there were 6 of them.
6 bottles of urine in his recycling bin. The garbage hauler wouldn't take it. It's biohazard.
First of all, somebody was thirsty. That's what I'm going to say. But secondly, you could say it's kind of awful to throw away 6 bottles of urine in someone's recycling bin. But it's better than him putting the urine out on the streets, which was probably what was happening previous to this. So he's peeing in bottles instead of on the streets. They should be happy. This guy's a hero in Portland, with the one exception, of course, if he's putting into the wrong trash container, he should be tried at The Hague.
Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Cool, wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Hol dir dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer?